This is The Political Animals, conversations at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole, and in this episode, I talk to Tim Wilson about faith and politics in New Zealand. Tim, welcome to the show.
Well, kia ora, Jonathan, or should I say g'day? How are you?
I think it's g'day, mate. You left out the mate.
Oh, see. Already it's somewhat awkward. There's a chasm opening up between us.
Our differences are already exposed.
They are. Nice to be with you nonetheless. See, I'm a New Zealander. I'm always going to rush to consensus and politeness. It's like, well, I still like you.
All right, this is going to be fun. Tim, you've already outed yourself as a Kiwi.
Yes.
Which Australian listeners will know immediately from your accent. And I could have started the show by asking you to pronounce the words six and sex next to each other just to amuse Australians, but maybe we can revisit that big global issue later in the show.
I thought you were about to say, but I'm too august to dignify such a tawdry vaudeville trope. This is high level stuff, Jonathan.
It is. But we can, you know, this is where we're just displaying the familiarity, the kind of brotherly familiarity between Australians and New Zealanders, because it takes a level of security to be able to take the piss out of each other's culture and accents and, national identity. But yeah, I digress, yeah. Tim. So yeah. the whole point of that, whatever that was to say that you've already introduced one important thing about you, which is that you are a Kiwi. But for the benefit of listeners, why don't you tell them a little bit about who Tim Wilson is?
Sure. At the moment, I am executive director at Maxim Institute, which is a public policy research and analysis think tank. Essentially, we help leaders make wise decisions. We've been around for about 20 years. And the way that we operate is through doing research on political issues. And also, we operate an internship where we're interested in leadership. And we want to help form the next generation of leaders. There is, I don't know what things are like in Australia, but there's, I think, in some sense, certainly in this country, as we've looked over the previous few years, certainly cabinet, you know, when you find there was an issue earlier this year, Jonathan, don't know if you saw it, but if you find that the Minister of Justice is being pursued by police dogs on a suburban street in your capital city, there's probably a leadership issue going on in some way, shape, or form. So. So look, we're interested in leadership and as well as that, engaging in, I hope, fruitful conversations with people like yourself. So that's what Maxim does. Before I was in Maxim, I worked in media, so print, TV, radio. I may well be the only person who's done capsule book reviews for the New York Times, but also written for Woman's Day. So I hold on to both of those very tightly. And also, when I had more spare time, my darling bride, Rachel, and I have four boys under the age of eight, but I used to write novels. And so I've written three novels, one of which was a finalist, but not a winner and a prize here. I'll get over it. I think I've done my grieving. So.
Is the novel writing something you plan to return to at some stage in your life?
Well, I started off really loving poetry. So at the age of 13, I had an English school teacher who introduced me to T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, and I was just captivated by the music of that poem. And so I actually have gone, because I have less time now, I write and publish poetry. So. I don't know if I'd return to novels because I think, well, I don't know, there's something about poetry that is, it's crystallizing. there's also a sort of a danger there, whereas in novels there are much more layers. You can, particularly fiction, you can say, well, this is what I want to project. But ideally in poetry, you say, well, this is what I want to reveal.
Fantastic, Tim. So the topic of our discussion, yes, broadly, who knows exactly where it will will go, and based on the introduction, one doesn't know. We want to talk about faith and politics in New Zealand. And I have to plead extreme ignorance on this account. I think, yeah, like a lot of Australians, I have been to New Zealand twice, once earlier this year where I got to spend some time with you, Tim, which was awesome in Auckland, and once, yeah, as part of a counterterrorism delegation when I was working in the intelligence business to Wellington for a big global conference. But I really,
you don't know much. You know,
in thinking about this episode, I was struck by just how ignorant I am of New Zealand history, politics, and the like. And I don't know if being the, how do I put this delicately, the bigger dog out of the two dogs in this.
You are. It's marginal. Okay. You're the older brother. I'm the younger brother. I'm cool with it.
Well, I mean, like we're just obviously,
yeah,
five times your size in population, and goodness knows how many times size in land. And so Australians tend, when they look overseas, they tend to look straight to America, yeah, these days, because I guess it's the greatest political drama on earth. So I don't know if New Zealanders are a little more across Australian politics and vice versa, but the whole point of what I'm saying is that I view this very much as faith and politics for Australian and, in brackets, other dummies, because I am a dummy when it comes to New Zealand politics.
What you're saying is Australia's a country, New Zealand's possibly an electorate, or maybe even a state if we're lucky. And I think at one point there was a possibility of us being the seven states. We may claim that. We may want to return to Australia at some point. You'd have us, wouldn't you?
Well, there's already, I think, over a million of you here, aren't there, or something in the order of
a million. It has begun, Jonathan.
So, look, I think it would be...
Having said that, you're sending us your gang members, so, you know...
We send
our hardworking, self-motivated people who want to get somewhere, and you give us the 501s. That's what a sweet deal.
Yeah, but you are right. I believe New Zealand may have been in the picture at one of the constitutional conventions, and Western Australia wasn't. And then for some reason, not across the detail, New Zealand decided to go its own way and Western Australia joined, then regretted and voted to leave, but the British monarch nixed that. And my other cheeky question, apart from talking about the quixotic New Zealand pronunciation of six and sex and the amusement that generates, yes, at least for Australians, I can't speak for other.
What should we just do this? Six, sex. There's a difference.
There is a difference, but the numeral does sound dangerously close to the...
I'll just say six then. How about that?
Have you never encountered problems overseas with that interesting pronunciation of the word six?
No. I lived in New York for 11 years and no one ever said, wait, what did you just say?
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know. It's maybe this... I think this goes back to the older brother thing, younger brother thing, where... the older brother is always saying, come on, that's not quite as good as it could be.
Yeah. No worries.
But look, it's actually interesting, you know, when you're describing the size disparity between Australia and New Zealand and the fact that Australia, say, looks more naturally to America for a representation perhaps of some of the – or an iteration of some of the political dramas that might be playing out here. We feel the same way when we look to Australia. And if you you're talking about population difference as well, we are we have about 5 million in New Zealand. In many ways, that affects the kind of politics that we have. So New Zealanders, when I look to Australia, I see a lot more intellectual variety in your politics, but also the ways in which political ideas are transacted. Mm-hmm. New Zealand, we tend, because we're smaller, I think we like to run to consensus as a society. I think Australians like to disagree, not as much as Americans. Americans will disagree with you about almost anything, but that's the nature of their well, I suppose that their society is probably more politicized as well. We're quite apolitical. We're actually talking about, what is it? Well, we've already talked, I suppose, tangentially about sex, but we're talking about religion, politics, and sex, the three things that you never talk about in New Zealand because people will just clear their throats and try and find something else to talk about.
On a serious note, I think with a population of 5 million, it actually makes consensus more possible, which begs the question, is it about temperament or is it actually about size? That is, and I guess you could do a comparative analysis of countries of a similar size, although I'm sure we might find some that are racked in conflict, but then that may be attributable to ethnic or religious cleavages or historical differences about borders and the like. Just let's pursue this politics question for my sake and the sake of other listeners who may not be particularly plugged into New Zealand politics. Paint a picture of the landscape. I mean, I know a little bit, and of course, everyone will have heard of Jacinda Ardern, the greatest political leader of the 21st century, and we might come back to that. But
who are you talking about?
who are the major parties?
Yeah.
Who are the major personalities? What do they stand for or believe in?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. There are two major parties and a number of smaller parties. We have a mixed member proportional system. So we're currently heading towards that there'll be an election in 3 days, and then there'll be a period where a coalition has to be formed. It's not clear that any of the major parties will be able to govern alone. In fact, that hasn't happened for a while. So let me summarise. The current government comprises Labour, which is a party. Well, you say they're a socialist party, centre left. Labour, which is led by the current Prime Minister, Chris Hipkins. He took that mantle from Jacinda Ardern after she vacated it at the beginning of the year. He is someone who's been, you're been in Wellington. He is someone who has been in and around policymaking for a long time. So I think that's one of the things I would note too about our politicians is that, say, in the early 70s, there were more working class people who ended up in Parliament. That's less the case now. In fact, it's not the case at all, as I understand it. So just, I don't know what the situation's like in Australia where people, say, from the trades or from the shop floor will end up in the seats of government, but and that's something that's changed, I think, over the last 50 years. So that's Labour, the current government. So it's Labour and the Greens. Greens, obviously, environmentally, they're co-led by James Shaw and Marama Davidson, I was about to say that she just made the news saying that we should debate calling the IDF a terrorist organization if we're going to call Hamas a terrorist organization. So, and this is sort of like, so that's obviously not necessarily an ecological position. So in the case of the Greens, and I once during a radio interview, I made the offhanded comment to James Shaw, he's got a more sort of corporate background. I said, your issue with your party is you're a mixture of trampers and Trotskyites. And that's not entirely fair. And I was trying to be provocative. But there is that sense with the Greens of identity politics being strongly entrenched alongside ecological climate change issues. And I would say to some extent as well, Labor has been accused by some people of migrating from the usual working class concerns, quote unquote working class concerns, and grasping the identity politics matrix as well. So that's a sort of a summary of Labor and the Greens. There's also we also have a party, Māori Party, Te Pāti Māori, and there's a couple of electorate MPs who are in Parliament. They tend to side with Labor and the Greens, but they're also, is that because they're disposed to them? I would say somewhat, but they're also disinclined, I think, to go with National, which I'm going to get to, which is the centre-right party. But interestingly, as a sort of historic footnote, during the John Key government, he was a National Prime Minister during the, I think, the late aughts, early teens. There was an alliance between the Maori Party, it was called the Maori Party then, and National, which was unexpected, because typically Maori have voted along with Labour, and that's something that goes all the way back to the time of Michael Joseph Savage in the 1930s. But that's probably a bit too much history. So we've got National, which is centre-right. You would say it's that National would be economically conservative, mostly socially liberal. From my point of view, I don't understand how that works, in the sense that if you agree that there are certain rules governing human behaviour economically, and these rules are expoundable, and this is how you are able to plan for economics, then why wouldn't you accept that there are certain rules that govern human behaviour socially? And they are also explicable and legible, and if you adhere to them, you'll lead a fuller life. But that's probably another discussion. National used to be, and the leader of National is a guy called Christopher Luxon. He comes from a corporate background. So you're looking at, say, Chris Hipkins from Labor, who comes from a public policy and parliamentary background. Christopher Luxon used to be the head of Air New Zealand, which I'm sure many of your listeners have flown upon and enjoyed, but also was involved with Unilever in the States as well. So he's got strong corporate background. Now, alongside, when we look at the further to the right, there's the ACT Party, which is a libertarian party. Essentially, ACT stands for Association of, what is it, Coalition of Taxpayers. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know. That's embarrassing, but... they are a party that are libertarian. They're obviously, I would say, again, economically fairly conservative, but in that libertarian way of individual freedoms. So they were the party that proposed and promulgated the euthanasia legislation that was passed during the last term. See that as an outpouring of their views on personal freedom. They're run by a guy called David Seymour, who he's actually an ex-think tank guy. He's a very astute politician in the sense that he's quite I think because of his libertarian views, there's a clarity that and also he doesn't have to. This is I don't know how many parties you have in Australia, but he doesn't have to campaign to the centre, so you can say things more strikingly when you're looking for the margins of a vote, rather than the sort of, you know, the centrist politicians. They tend to be a bit squishy in their pronunciations. Is that the case in Australia?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's striking the similarities that have developed in our party politics, because obviously one of our major parties is a Labor Party too, which I imagine has similar roots in the union movement, but has undergone a similar evolution to what it sounds like your Labor Party has undergone, where now it's certainly the popular perception is it's a kind of inner city latte drinking, kind of pseudo intellectual progressive work identity politics. Although in truth, that's only a part of our Labour Party, because there are factions with more conservative elements and more radical elements. And then, of course, we've got a Green Party that's at the lunatic end of politics in terms of, like that example you gave with the IDF, and they've been a major force. Yeah, the Labour Party in Australia is never really governing coalition, although there was a minority Labour government under Julia Gillard, and I think one of the Greens members may have had something to do with that, although where I live in the ACT, there's been a Labour-Greens coalition government for ages, and the Labour Party's been in power for, I think, over 20 years in the ACT. But then on the right, it's interesting because we've obviously got the Liberal Party, but it's quite divided ideologically. And so your depiction of National meets...
Look, I think you're right. This is an interesting... I think what we're seeing is the sort of fracturing of the modes by which we understood political arrangements. So as we've described, I think in both countries, the left sort of migrating from a class-based understanding of what justice might look like or what their policies might look like. It's the same on the right as well. As you've noted, National used to be the party of farmers. So New Zealand, obviously, how we make our lunch internationally or eat our lunch internationally is by selling stuff we grow on farms, milk, animals, etc., to the rest of the world. Now, that's not the case. When you're talking about the latte-sipping Labour voters, there are latte-sipping National voters who would probably have more in common with that person sitting across the cafe from them who's wearing the Labour rosette than they might with a farmer. So it's a fascinating time to cast your eye around politics.
That's actually interesting to learn, Tim, that your National began as a farming party, because we have a National Party in Australia originally called the Country Party, which sounds very much like a similar origin story. And of course, none of this is probably perplexing, because we were both British colonies colonized at the same time, similar traditions, and there was a lot of intercourse between our nations. So they
did the British want to colonize you, because they really, really put off colonizing us. There was not a lot of appetite for actually declaring New Zealand to be a British colony. They tried to put it off.
Oh, so you mean you weren't ever a British colony?
Oh, no, we were.
Oh, right.
They faffed around for about 100 years before they actually did it.
Oh, because, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like, and this is, again, and I only say this because I'm the younger brother and I want to make a point of our smallness. But it's part of, I think part of what informs our political discourse in New Zealand is the fact that we're so small, we're geographically far away. In many senses, we're a footnote. And if you look at international affairs, for example, and the place that international affairs holds in our political discourse, it's negligible. Whereas you guys are talking about AUKUS, you're worried about the geopolitics of China, for example. For us, that's not the kind. It's really interesting. We're actually, in some sense, more internal looking, because we don't see ourselves as participating in those kinds of uncertainties.
Yeah.
Because we're a footnote. But of course, the world is coming to us as the world is getting smaller.
Yeah. And although we forged our brotherhood together on the shores of Gallipoli with the great shared Anzac legend. Unlike you, we love fighting wars right up till today and love a good war with America. And so that tends to make foreign policy a much more central issue when you've constantly sending troops overseas to fight here, there. And
I think we participated in Afghanistan and it's Skip. I wasn't here at the time, so I was actually in the US during the Iraq conflict. Yeah. But we sort of grudgingly participate. One of the signal moments of 80s politics was our refusal to accept nuclear-powered submarines operated by the United States because of, well, I'm not sure why. We just decided we decided we were nuclear-free. But I think it was actually, as I review it, my sense is that there was actually a Labor government that implemented some very conservative economic programs, and they needed to feed their base something. So they said, okay, we're going to tell America that they can't bring their submarines in here. We're going to be, quote-unquote, independent.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I began my intelligence career in 2007, I was a little surprised to learn that New Zealand was still in the naughty corner.
Yeah.
And being punished by America with certain types of intelligence not available to the New Zealand government directly as one of the, still in 2007, one of the consequences of that nuclear. Although I have a feeling that may have changed by the time I left in 2014. But I just want to come back to this question of the National, because obviously our major centre-right party is the Liberal Party, which governs in coalition with our National party, the farmer party, and still a party of the regions. They don't even contest seats in the cities.
Really? Oh,
no.
Interesting.
And the Liberal Party can't govern without, it can't win enough seats on its own. And the Liberal Party itself, I think it would be fair to say that the National Party is the most conservative sort of major party in Australia. There are arguably parties to the right, like One Nation, but it's a kind of hot mess most days
of
the year.
Is that more of a single issue party?
Well, that's I think One Nation is, it's not a single issue party. It's kind of a complex party because it revolves around the personality of Pauline Hanson and her unique history. There's a bunch of, but it's more, I would say, at the populist right, whereas the National Party is a kind of socially conservative party, and in the coalition, that's where you find, not exclusively, but some of the most conservative members of the coalition in the federal parliament. Whereas the Liberal Party, at least in recent times, has been locked in this perpetual factional warfare between, and this goes to some of the issues you were outlining earlier in relation to New Zealand. The socially progressive but economically liberal members, and then the socially conservative members who aren't always as economically liberal. And we're talking about people in the Liberal Party who would identify themselves as conservatives. And so I wanted to ask you, where are the conservatives in New Zealand? Because the kind of way you're talking about National left me with the impression that the kind of ideological weight is with that particular faction of the Australian Liberal Party that's kind of socially progressive and economically liberal, to put it in our terms.
And I think both the Liberal and the National Party, they have a history of being a broad church. So there are socially conservative members within that party. Can I just get to One Nation, where you're saying is a party that revolves around the personality of a particular Christine Hanson. Pauline Hanson. We have a similar party that is called New Zealand First revolves around a politician called Winston Peters. He's been around forever. He's a sort of refugee from the National Party, but he started his own party, New Zealand First. And that's a party that was concerned about migration during a particular time. Obviously, migration is something of an issue in New Zealand. It's also an economic issue because it's, given our demographic situation, it's how we grow as a country. But Winston Peters, can I just say, he's actually become a player during this election campaign. Suddenly, he's sort of back and is the one that may well hold the balance of power. Although Labor has said explicitly they won't go with Winston because of because they see him as a chaotic player. But Winston is he's an incredible politician. He's intuitive. He's aggressive. He's pugnacious. He really attracts a certain kind of voter, say a voter who wants the protest vote, in a sense. I don't know if Pauline Hanson attracts protest votes as well, but we do have our version of that kind of thing. Sorry, that's just a footnote. That and that has become, New Zealand First has become resurgent during this campaign for a variety of reasons. To get back to whether there are, I guess you're asking, are there economic and social conservatives within National?
Let me put it even more precisely. Are there politicians in National or other parties who would describe themselves as conservatives? I mean, have to assume there's some constituency of conservative voters in New Zealand who would embrace that term, or if not embrace the term, could be described empirically as conservative.
Can I press on you just to define what conservative in your view would mean? Is that economic, or is that socially conservative as well? What's the—
this is the thorniest question.
I know, mean of me to ask you, wasn't it?
Because, well, it's a serious question. The reality is that the definition is not stable and it's contested.
Well, it's not an ism, I think. Yeah.
Well, the thing is that there are two ways to define any political concept of this nature. And one is what I call the sociological method, which is you take everyone that calls himself, in this case, a conservative, and then you feed it into the machine and you pump out a definition that can encompass all of them. That's going to be quite a complex, subtle definition, because you're going to— but what you do, its virtue is you capture the diversity of those who—
very democratic of you, Jonathan.
Yeah. The other one is to come up with a normative definition. Mm. Now, that has the virtue of being simpler, but the problem then is you find it always excludes some people that use the term about themselves, and you're then locked in this perpetual battle of trying to define people out of the term who use it. So I always preference the sociological term, although I could offer a normative definition for myself, because I am a conservative in a sort of political philosophical sense, but I'm not in this business of excommunicating people I disagree with, even people who I think are a libertarian, not a conservative, or what I might call a right-wing populist rather than a conservative. If they use the term conservative, then I try and incorporate that in my conception of what a conservative is. And this is based on the fact that people don't embrace a term for no reason. Like if you're identifying yourself with conservatism, even if it's a strange definition, then you have to assume there's some reason for that, that they're choosing that term and not some other.
Roger Scruton, who says it's an attitude of love, in the sense that, and it's almost as much dispositional as it is ideological. It's interesting because sometimes people who are part of people who see themselves as conservatives will say, "Hey, I thought you were conservative because you're saying this or that," and I think those sort of ideological truth tests are sort of more for the left, the left side of the aisle, in the sense that I think what is attractive to me about the conservative disposition, and I say that's a disposition, it's like, well, what do you love, and how do you ensure that what you love travels from one generation to the next generation, and sometimes you ensure that by doing absolutely nothing, and that's quite countercultural. But to do that rather than to say, hey, what's your position on issue X, Y, or Z? Now I'll accept you into my inner sanctum. Yeah. I think there's the, I like that that you're alluding to that in some ways with the definition of conservative. Shall I race ahead and try and answer your question?
Yeah, look, I think it's probably best if you define it however you want from a New Zealand context, because I don't know.
No, look, I guess for want of a better word, in National there is a place for MPs such as Simon O'Connor, who is anti-abortion, very strongly anti-abortion, anti-euthanasia, practicing Catholic, very very visible about his faith, and also has great reservations about the geopolitical influence of China. Now, what's interesting from Simon's point of view is that he's an electorate MP. So in MMP, as we've constructed it, there's a party list and there's an electorate list. And sometimes, you know, electorate MPs can be on the list, that if a party receives a certain percentage of the vote, then a particular number of their MPs will be admitted into Parliament. So there's a mixture of local politicians and then party certified politicians. Simon is someone who he's been in his electorate for a number of years, and so that's where his I guess you could say his power base is. But there are other MPs too who espouse Christian faith, who are, I would say, socially conservative. But there's also, there's an anxiety, sometimes an antagonism around them. Like the nickname that has been coined, so it's reported in stories about those Christian MPs, is they've been described as the Taliban.
Really?
This has come out through several stories, that's the nickname that they have been given. So that gives you a sense of where they are in the party, but there are sections of the party who hugely distrust them.
Yeah. I do want to come to this faith question, and you've opened the door to it, and we will walk through it, but we can't do so before dealing with this Jacinda Mania question. I should just note as a footnote that Winston Peters is the one other politician I could have from New Zealand I could have named who gets a lot of press in, who makes the news regularly in Australia. Yeah. In fact,
how do you know about Winston?
He came to prominence when he held the balance of power or helped the government form.
In 2017.
Yeah. And he was a foreign minister for a while, wasn't he? And
yes, he was. Yeah.
And
a pretty good foreign minister.
You know, he's one of those guys that has the ability to say provocative things that make the news here. And I think I even saw an article about him in The Australian today or yesterday. But apart from him and Jacinda Ardern, who's probably known globally, in all seriousness, probably one of the best known sort of political leaders, at least amongst that global elite class. And watching that from Australia, and again, just putting my flag down, you know, as a conservative, was kind of interesting but also bizarre. And I wonder what it was like as a New Zealander watching this global acclaim. And if you have any insight to offer on what you think was going on there, because that must have been very unusual for a New Zealand Prime Minister to become literally an international darling of that the sort of all the things that the right hates, the kind of globalist elite and the sort of Davos crowd and all that kind of.
Yeah. Look, I guess you're asking, what was it like to be there at the time? Well, she got the job of leading the Labour Party because they were desperate. They were trailing in the polls. There was an election in 10 weeks. And I remember, this was when I was working in TV, I did a series of, I was like, well, does anyone even know who's currently, this was the previous leader, was a guy called Andrew Little. And I vox popped a bunch of people in town saying, who's the leader of the Labour Party? And they're like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And who knows, maybe that piece was instrumental in creating Jacinda Ardern, Jonathan.
So you're declaring here, yeah, on the Political Animals that you're the reason.
No, I will say I will say that perhaps I was a barometer that was able to determine why she was, or I contributed to the atmospheric pressure that created Jacinda Ardern.
But Tim, presumably, yeah, if that little fella was unknown, and this is 10 weeks before an election, I mean, was Jacinda known
She was visible. Let's put it that way. She had been, she was in Mount Albert, which I could be wrong, from memory, was Helen Clark's seat. So she had, the mantle had been placed upon her. Our first child took away 95% of my memory. The next one took 95% of the remaining 5%, et cetera, et cetera. And I have, my darling and I have four sons. So you'll forgive me if I get some of this.
So you have about 0.01% left.
I'm just winging it, Jonathan. So I think she was someone who was always on the radar. So to see her so quickly enshrined as a leader, I think created a kind of, and look, the configurations of media loves the expected unexpected. And so to see her elevated so swiftly, there was a honeymoon period that contributed to, and she is, I was about to describe her as an empathetic politician. I'm not sure she is to people who disagree with her ideologically, but she conveyed a sense of being empathetic that perhaps the other politicians at the time weren't so good at. So I guess, what is it? Is it, I'll use the phrase media savvy, in that, and if you look at the government under her, there was a real focus on communication. So she was a great communicator. Practically speaking, and I think there are people within the Labour Party would agree with this, there's not a lot of delivery for much of, and this is a problem that Labour's wrestling with at the moment, I think, in terms of what do we say to our base that we've achieved. Now, they have achieved some things, but certainly, there was the hope that Jacinda Ardern would head a quote-unquote transformational government, and that's that those hopes have not been realised. So you have a young woman, you have someone who is able to be able to be well represented in media and social media, there was a sense of this is a new era. Now I don't think that sense is validated. You look at, for example, Barack Obama. And I was in the US when he was elected. Hope, change. There wasn't much change. He was actually a candidate of the establishment who masqueraded as an outsider. My view is actually that the appetite for a Donald Trump-like figure, a true populist, was created by, if you like to say, politically, the father of Barack Obama is Donald Trump. Pardon me, the father of Donald Trump is Barack Obama, because he created an appetite that was then assuaged by a genuine populist. I'm not talking about any of his views or something. I did spend an afternoon with Donald Trump. Maybe that's another story.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Oh, well, we can't pass over that.
Do you want to get into it now?
Yeah. You can't dangle that and then casually move on.
No. Jonathan, this is not your first rodeo. You want the listeners to keep listening, so I'll do my boring analysis of Jacinda Ardern. Let's get to Donald Trump. I spent the afternoon with him because he was the face of New Zealand Lotto in 2008.
So if you face win, of New Zealand Lotto, that's so random.
If you win Lotto, you could have a Trump lifestyle. And so what's it like? So I went to interview Donald Trump in the Gold Tower on Fifth Avenue, and spent the afternoon with him. Fascinating character. Like, I think the thing that, I have an anecdote. I'll tell you. Like with Donald, when you meet Donald Trump, you know the power handshake.
Yeah,
I'm on the top. You're on the bottom.
All right.
It goes on and on.
Really?
And on and on. But the thing is, Donald Trump is a germaphobe. He hates touching strangers.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he would have saturated his hand with sanitizer the moment that my attention was diverted. But he likes being the power guy. So he hates touching people, but he needs to touch them to be the power guy. And so it goes. And also one of the most it wasn't an untidy desk, but it was an orderly desk that was filled with reams of paper.
Really?
And I don't understand how he would have – I mean, obviously he's a paper – I'm a bit of a paper guy myself because I process things by writing them down. But there were reams of paper, like stacks, like Proustian amounts of paper sheets on – and they were all orderly, but I don't know how the hell anyone could get through that because, you know, the filing just –
Sounds like he's a bit of a hoarder.
I think he is a bit of a hoarder. And the other thing was he didn't want us to film in his office, and then he relinquished and let us film his office, and that's how I saw his desk.
Oh, okay. Mm. Interesting. Wow, that's not many people have met Donald Trump, let alone interviewed him, and that's interesting to do that just before.
2008.
He became the political Donald Trump we know.
Oh yeah, he was like The Apprentice. He was like You're Fired Donald Trump.
Yeah.
At the time, he was a reality star. And I guess it was what I took away with at the time was this guy's a real estate guy. So it's all he was extremely charming.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to be charming to me because this was part of his job to be the face of New Zealand Lotto, which I'm sure he was getting paid to be, et cetera, et cetera. But interestingly, I did a piece that I thought was somewhat humorous, lightly joshing, and I thought, we'll be back in the Gold Tower. Called his staff up 3 months later, said, can I interview Donald Trump for issue X? And they're like, no, Mr. Trump did not like your story.
Really?
Very, very thin-skinned.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So that story, even though I guess in the scheme of his world, with no disrespect, it was just one of probably hundreds of sort of meaningless media things he does to promote himself.
It was a gentle, fluffy roughing of his hair. But
that was remembered. And And so it's like not speaking to that bloke again because
I'm not going to have that schmuck in my tower again.
Yeah, interesting. Just going back to Jacinda Ardern, I suppose it's interesting.
It was also a populist in some sense. You know, if you think of people who galvanize and crystallize attention, Jacinda Ardern is someone who has been able to do that from a completely different position to Donald Trump.
I think the parallel with Barack Obama is apt because both of them electrified the media and a segment of society the moment they came into power before they'd actually done anything. And, you know, you had these absurd things with Obama, like winning the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, my goodness.
Mentioning the word Middle East, which today is not looking too good, is it?
The Middle East is looking dreadful at the moment. You're absolutely right. I actually did an interview with, when that was announced, I did an interview with we had a live out of the 6 p.m. news. And there was a guy there called Peter Williams who was reading the news. And he said, so what's going on with this? Da, 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 da. And I was like, well, there doesn't seem to be any rationale for this Peace Prize. And I said, who knows, Peter, play your cards right. You might win the Nobel Peace Prize next year. And my foreign editor, the moment that I got off the line, he phoned me up. How dare you editorialize on the news and say something as frivolous and flippant as that? But it was true. I mean, there was no reason why he had been awarded the prize. I think there was just the burden of the aspirations that were on him, and those aspirations were real. When I was actually in Chicago, running towards Grant Park, where all of his, where he spoke for the first time as the first African American president of the United States, and I was running past African American men in their 60s and 70s who were weeping because they had. I mean, this was genuine. I think in the case of Jacinda, it's a different I think a different atmosphere. But it's I think you're right. She was an establishment figure as well as in the same way that he was.
But I guess what I was thinking was that the international fawning and salivating over adulation. Her really had nothing to do with New Zealand. I mean, these people not only would be ignorant of what party she was from and the political context and social and cultural contests, but probably couldn't care less. Mm. It was just, here's this figure. And it's what she represented, a sort of, I think she's born in 1980, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So a young, very engaging, like you say, great communicator. And that is sort of new in, let's face it, a global political culture of old blokes.
Often I think
running things for decades.
what's the quote? Politics is rock and roll for ugly people, and it's not my quote. But I think there is, for those figures who somehow break the mold, and that may be a matter of image or whatever, that and I think this, we talk about the desire for an egalitarian society. Well, I don't know. I don't know if we do, because we're naturally drawn to arrange ourselves so that there are people who lead us.
Yeah.
And we select those leaders often, or sometimes for very trivial reasons, but we still desire to look up to people. It's part of the human condition to look up to people. And I would argue to look up to God as well, whether we acknowledge that hunger or not. And she was someone who was elevated because of some particular skills she had and characteristics, and so people looked up to her.
I do want to walk through the God door, but again,
come in
when you're talking.
Come in, I've just opened a second bottle of scotch.
It's just I can't pass over this because it's not every day I have someone with your media experience on the show, and that was just very interesting the way you got in trouble with your editor. For what is a pretty, I think, astute observation, but I gather on a live cross on the nightly news.
This is the news.
So I was just wondering, I mean, I don't know how we could do this in 5 minutes, but I'm just going to throw it out there and you can say what you want. But as someone with that long and diverse career, print, TV, and radio, and I know you still do media. I think aren't you a political commentator on New Zealand radio, for example?
Yeah, I do. Ostensibly it's called Wrapping the Week on the Mike Hosking Breakfast, which is the largest breakfast show in the country. 2 weeks ago we talked about salt and vinegar chips. So it varies,
it's not just politics.
It's not just policy, but then again, that's as I think we've demonstrated, a good conversation it goes anywhere, and that's the power of radio. It's fantastic. Whereas TV's far more structured, more choreographed.
Before I get to the actual question, I should drop my own anecdote because it's pretty funny. But I made my television debut in New Zealand thanks to you, Tim, because I was out there doing some work with Maxim and. And I mean, it doesn't get more random than this. And I was with my very good friend, Paul Henderson. It was on Breakfast TV live
in New Zealand.
The impact of democracy, the impact of AI on democracy. And the experience for me was so bizarre because I'm in Auckland. I rock up to the studio of a TV channel I've never heard of. I sit down with two presenters I've never seen in my life. I can't even remember the name of the presenters or the TV station or the show. And then I have my first, it was like a 5-minute segment, and it was just an amazing.
You did a great job. You've got a few. I mean, if only free to air terrestrial TV wasn't declining, you might have another career awaiting.
Yeah, 30 years ago or something. So this brings me to the question. I mean, what did you learn through that career in the media? What's an insight or two you have to drop, particularly in relation? I guess I'm in the media in a way through the podcast, but it never feels like that because I've never actually worked in real media.
Yeah,
Yeah. But then that term real media, I mean, who knows what real media is these days?
Well, that's far more, it's far more disaggregated these days in terms of what media is. And look, I guess my background was print. So, and how did I get into print? Well, at the time I was driving a nighttime taxi in Auckland. That was my sort of, I went on the dole after university, tried to write poetry, got sick of being poor, became a nighttime taxi driver because the money was fantastic, wrote about it for a magazine writing competition and co-won the competition. And then another magazine, a sister magazine to the magazine Metro that had run that competition, needed a young journalist. So they said, "Hey, Schmucko, why don't you come aboard?" And that's how I ended up as a print journalist. And that was, I guess, I'm saying all of this to note that what you learn, I think you learn different things in different media. Mm-hmm. So as a print journalist, I wrote 5,000 word stories for monthly magazines. So I was a long form person, but I disparaged TV, and I remember a television guy coming into the magazine and just the glittering nature of his suit, oozing insincerity and easy money, Jonathan, and I thought, I can't stand these people with their easy aphoristic formulations and their succinct throws, etc., to other correspondents, etc. And then I ended up as one of those people out of desperation. But I guess the point, out of desperation,
how did you end up in TV then?
Well, I went to New York to get the job that was awaiting me on The New Yorker. They just didn't know that there was a job waiting for me. And so I got so broke, I ended up with the cell phone of someone who had come for, had done some live crosses for TVNZ. And so one day this friend, Lauren, she said, "Look, I was actually someone, I didn't even have a social security card because I was just like in the gray zone." So she said, "Here, I'm paying off this cell phone on a monthly basis. I'm going back to New Zealand. You can have the cell phone if you." I was like, "Oh, wow, a Motorola flip phone. That's amazing. I'll do that." And one day that phone rang and it was TVNZ. And the voice said, "Hello, is Lauren there?" And I said, no, she's not." Then there was a pause and I said, "Do you need a journalist?" And the voice said, "Yeah, I do." And I said, "I'm a journalist." And the next night I was in a studio over Times Square doing a live into the late news.
And then you became, if I'm not mistaken, you became the channel's New York, America.
Yeah, right? I ended up through a series of misadventures. I mean, I was very blessed to have someone, a mentor who gave me second and third chances when I stuffed up. My first big job for TVNZ, I blew chunks. I FTD'd. FTD means failed to deliver. You never want to FTD in TV, but that was my audition for the big role. But I got given a second chance, and I ended up doing that.
So you never even desired or sought TV?
No.
And you just kind of fell into it?
Yeah, I wanted to be one of those sort of international grotesques that are from nowhere that end up in the pages of the New Yorker.
Yeah.
Itching my intellectualism against the itching posts of the issues of the era. But I ended up in telly.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. Okay, that's I know we're jumping all over the place, but
no, we can do that.
That's fascinating. Okay. The God door. Let's talk about faith in New Zealand and really Christianity, because we're both Christians, and
we can say it. This is a quote unquote safe space, right, Jonathan?
yeah. You're allowed to be a Christian here. The Christianity in New Zealand, paint a picture, because I have to confess, I'm not well acquainted with the sort of denominational landscape, the way Christianity and the churches do or don't feature in New Zealand history, culture, politics.
Yeah. Well, I think I can run you through some of the numbers just very quickly, and then we can break that down. So the most recent one is the 2018 census. Nuns, i.e. no religion at all, 48%. Christians are 37%. If we break that down, 6.7% are Anglicans, 6.2% are Roman Catholic. By the way, I'm Catholic. I became Catholic in New York. Non-denominational, that's 6.6%. Presbyterian, Congregational, Reformed, 5.2%. Baptist, 0.8%, which is, I think that's a bit sad for the Baptists. I've got some nice Baptist mates. So I guess the point being, though, in a wider context, is that in New Zealand, and I've noticed this, I framed it this way, which is like, in the United States, if you don't say that you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, you will not be elected president of that country. Mm-hmm. In New Zealand, if you do affirm that you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, there is no chance that you will ever, ever be prime minister of this country. And the reason for that is that faith is seen not as a public matter, it's a private issue between yourself and God. We go back to that the triumvirate of awkwardness that I was saying. Yeah. What are the things we don't talk about? Religion, politics, and sex.
I think you mean religion, politics, and the number six.
And the number six. Yeah, we never mention the number. You did that very well. Ow, that hurts. That hurts.
Just a warning to listeners, do not raise the number six in New Zealand. You'll get into trouble.
You'll get into trouble. Look, it was interesting because, I came to sort of understand this. My first novel was actually about the rapture. Their faces were shining. Victoria University Press. There's a great aftermarket in it if you want to get it cheap. anyway, but I was asked by a magazine called New Zealand Books to sort of summarize faith literature in New Zealand, or literature in and around faith, because there's a tradition, say, in the United States, of faith-based literature. You think of Flannery O'Connor, you think of Walker Percy, or literature that at least engages with faith. There's none of that in New Zealand, or very little, very little. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I do note that someone like your current Prime Minister is able to say, oh, I'm Catholic, I'm Catholic and Labour, and that's okay, whereas it's not, I think, the emphasis or the ability to emphasize the faith, your faith journey is not seen as something that is conducive to political success in our country because of the cultural norms, for want of a better word.
So this is interesting. There's a fairly widespread, not universal, but fairly widespread and growing perception amongst Christians in Australia that Australia's secular culture or society is becoming more suspicious and or hostile towards Christianity, and that there are growing costs for talking about your faith publicly or taking certain stands on public issues and attributing it to your
faith
and the like. And of course, you know, there are cancellation stories here and there, and there are there's some evidence for it. It's quite a complex issue. I have nuanced views on it myself, but that's not the point here. It sounds like, if anything, you may be even further ahead down a path of hostility, or is that not the way that New Zealand Christians would characterize the situation?
I think hostility is not something we generally do in New Zealand. We do we do passive aggression.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, again, this goes back, and I'm playing a bit fast and loose with a cultural characteristic here. But we tend to, it's more that it's just there are some things that we don't discuss because historically we haven't discussed them. So I think but what you're describing is also, and we talk about Christians, it's very hard to talk about Christians coherently because there's so many different kinds of Christians. So there are Christians who would identify as, and I'll, I'll I'll use the phrase so-called progressives, because I don't like to use the word progressives, because that imagines an advance in human behavior and history.
You mean regressives then?
Well, I think actually, I think if you look at the history of the 20th century, yes, the quote unquote so-called progressive mode is actually regressive, because you're hearkening back to schemes and utopian aspirations that produce corpses. But so in New Zealand, I think I'm assuming this is the same in Australia, is that the church, when we talk about the church, there's actually a spectrum of those who inhabit the church, and the church is actually grappling. I think the churches in the West are grappling with the gospel of politics as much as it's grappling with the gospel of Christ. So I think that's something that is consistent throughout the Western experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, this is a bit of a sidebar, but it is relevant. I'm about to give a paper on Edmund Burke's political theology, and what I've discovered is that in Reflections, and this has really escaped attention of scholars as far as I can see, he actually is one of the earliest, possibly the earliest, to use the term political theologian in English. This is in 1790, and it's a term of opprobrium. And he has this interesting line where he says that politics and the pulpit are terms that have little agreement. Now, this is a guy who thinks the Christian religion is integral to the English constitution. He's in favor of an established church. He goes so far as to say that the kind of Christian view of the human being consecrates, quote, the Commonwealth. So he sees and he says, you know, in the English, the church and the state, there's no essential difference or separation, or words to those effects. So this is a guy who sees this intimate, integral relationship between the church and the state, the Commonwealth and society. And yet he thinks that politics and the church should be entirely separate. And it's interesting because he says that they have distinct characters, and that if they intermingle, they undermine the character of each other. And the context here is he's criticizing the dissenting preacher Richard Price, who was an enthusiast of the French Revolution, and he gave a toast or speech in 1789 that caught the ire of Burke. And it's interesting. He says that the church, the only sound that should be heard in the church is the voice of Christian charity. And he says at one point, you know, can we not have one day's truce from the animosities and dissensions of humankind? Now, what I think he's arguing, this does actually relate to what you're saying, believe it or not, after I finish the lecture. So
I'm enjoying the lecture.
I'll very subtly wake you up when I finish. But I think he's got a conception of politics here of conflict, and he was a parliamentarian himself. He was well aware of factional disputes, policy debates and disputes. That was the air he breathed as a member of the English Parliament. And so I think he thought politics was a realm of conflict and human passion, and that's quite a common definition or understanding of politics. And I think he thought the church, perhaps this is a bit of an idealistic or romantic view, that its core political function was actually to be outside of politics and a refuge,
a sanctuary,
the dissensions and animosities of humankind. Now, what I like about
this, has he never been a member of a church?
I think he makes a very good point. Setting aside, I think it's very contentious, his actual picture of the church. But setting that aside, and it's not like he was unfamiliar with conflict. I mean, he's
within church. Yeah,
you know, he's from Dublin, and his father was a convert to the Church of Ireland, possibly so that he could become a lawyer, because, you know, Catholics, this is an age where there's lots of persecution of Catholics, and Burke himself had very enlightened views towards Catholics, and his mother and sisters, I think, were Catholics. So in any event, scholars have pored over that complex thing, and there's this outstanding question and debate about Burke's own religious views and piety. But I think there's an interesting idea here, which is, I'm just presenting the idea. I'm attracted to it, but I'm still processing it myself as I work out exactly what I'm arguing in this paper. But this idea that there are different characters of politics and the politician and the church and the preacher, and that they're not actually compatible. This is Burke's, I think, fundamental point. And because they're not compatible, they actually do injury if the preacher goes into politics and the politician goes into religion, which is why he not only uses the phrase political theologian, but he also puts it next to the term theological politicians. And that's why it's a bad word in his view. And it's, again, it's got nothing to do with the separation of state and politics. He wants a huge role for religion. Mm. He thinks it holds humankind to a higher purpose. It gives a kind of transcendental, not his word, transcendent horizon for politicians, and calls them to be better. He just wants, he doesn't want the church in the rough and tumble of political debate.
Mm.
And to come to the point, and this is where I waved you to wake up, that I think the church today has lost this distinction. And it's perhaps not its fault, because it finds itself in this bizarre, it finds itself in a highly political and politicized an ideological age where there's lots of politics is intruded into every aspect of human existence.
Are you familiar with Augusto Del Noce?
No, I'm not.
He's an Italian thinker who predicted the politicization of everything in the 60s. Fascinating guy.
Oh, interesting.
And also the rise of ideology. So everywhere, which is concomitant with that, that politicization. To your point about Burke, is he prescribing then that you can be Christian in a political sphere, you just have to take time out of it to ensure that your connection with God is not diluted by that? Or is he saying you can't be a Christian in politics, or you can't be I guess you can be a politician in church, because they all come to church, or they often come to church during election time?
It's difficult to say, for the fact
he's not proposing anything. He's outlaying a dynamic to be aware of.
Yeah, and I'm also reconstructing what I would call a proto-political theology from different parts of his reflections on the revolution in France. So it's not that he's done a systematic treatment of it, and his own inimitable rhetoric. He has this wonderful description at the beginning of Reflections where he basically says, look, to the French aristocrat he's writing to, the letter to, that, you know, you'll have to indulge me. I'm just throwing my thoughts out as they occur without any kind of systematic method or words along those lines. Burke, of course, was a Christian politician, and you have to assume in the England of his day, virtually everyone in there was a politician.
Was Christian.
I believe that the first atheist who was elected to the British English Parliament was not allowed to take up his seat, and it caused this big scandal, and I think some litigation because I think there may have been some law prohibiting that. I think his point is, this is what I suspect he would say, or certainly what I read in his argument, that there's no problem with the Christian politician, provided they don't do theology or start trying to run the church or getting involved in religious matters. He probably thought it would have been a no-brainer that the politician would be a Christian, but they're not there to do theology and church stuff. They're there to do politics. And similarly, the preacher and on Sunday shouldn't be pontificating on politics or weighing into partisan matters. And the key here is that was Dr. Price's sin. He was a dissenting preacher.
Yeah.
who had taken a partisan position on the revolution in France, thought it would be a great thing to replicate in England, and he was criticizing the British monarchy, or English monarchy as I think it was then. It's hard to keep track of when it's England, Great Britain, United Kingdom, or United Kingdom comes later, and you know, Ireland's in and out and all that kind of stuff. So apologies to my British listeners. I'll have to do a British history for Australian dummies at some
point. You will.
Some point. And so I think, and again, it all comes back to this idea of what the intermingling does. And I think his point is that it's not cost-free. And so I think, and he actually, believe it or not, he has this phrase, political gospel. At one point he talks about Dr. Price promulgating a, quote, political gospel. He calls him a spiritual politician or something derisively.
That's interesting. I think we need to beware of any gospel that doesn't have notions of redemption and also notions of human sinfulness.
Yeah. So this is how I would characterize it. And I realize now, you know, I'm making you a passenger in this so-called interview that I'm doing with you. So you'll have to.
That's a conversation.
Forgive me, but you really, you know, what you said really resonated with the research I'm doing at the moment in terms of the church really losing sight of the sort of meaning of the gospel, which in the first place is not political, and being wrapped up in this political rough and tumble of the world today. And I think the key point that we should all think of, and this is particularly important for conservative Christians, I think, but also it applies to progressive Christians too, that once you become highly political as a church or as a theological matter, which means you start making theological arguments for
political
both political systems or like there's a debate about the voice at the moment, and there are all these arguments in favor of it that purport to be theological. Someone sent me one recently about, well, something to do with, it was this tortured argument about Jesus and his teaching in first century Palestine, as if that could have anything to do with a particular proposal for a constitutional amendment in Australia in 2023. And that's a prime example of how, if you bring them in, you muddy the waters, and I actually think you end up with a bad gospel and bad politics, whereas the Christian politician should be informed by their faith. And so for me, it should manifest more in your integrity as a person,
so you're
being able to exercise wise judgment.
Your character.
So yeah, your character.
Faith informs your character. I'm not a politician, but I would really struggle to not apply my understanding of faith to political systems and positions as well. I mean, it's so tempting. Not tempting. Yeah. Are we saying, so where does faith informs our character and forms our character. Then with that formation, we then enter the political realm and make the decisions we have based on our understanding of the world through the lens of the gospel.
Yeah.
Is that?
Put it this way, a Christian, I mean, I'm kind of thinking out loud here. I'm putting the view as a kind of provocation for listeners to think about. I'm still developing my thought on this myself. And I mean, I work in political theology and have for over a decade. So take that voice example I was talking about. There are plenty of respectable arguments in favor of the voice, but they don't have anything to do with Jesus' teaching.
Yeah.
His death and resurrection, what the Old Testament says about Israel. And it's much more credible as a Christian, if you support the voice, to do it on the arguments that actually relate to the 21st century and the Australian Constitution, and not this tortured effort to peg it somehow to the voice. I could think of conservative examples of this too.
What you're saying is don't attempt to sanctify a political position Now, you can use your understanding of what is sacred to reach a political position, but you don't elevate it using just like, well, I'm voting either way because of this passage of scripture.
Yeah.
That's not the way to create a political position or a political system.
Yeah, the more or less, and this is not Burke's argument, but this is what I take from Burke. So I'm grounding my perspective in Burke, and I think the key point is to recognize there's a distinction between politics and Christianity. They are not the same thing. That's not to say there isn't some intersection between them, but they actually have distinct characters. Now, the challenge Burke makes is there's a cost to the character of both if you conflate that distinction. And I think in this age, a lot of Christians on the left and right are conflating their distinction. Mm. And it's an easy thing to do in a subtle way. And I don't think the person that makes, for example, that voice argument realizes that in my view, that undermines the gospel to try and fit that square into a round hole of the voice, rather than just acknowledging that is not a topic that the Bible has anything to say on. And that doesn't mean a Christian can't vote for the voice, advocate for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a temptation, I think, and this is certainly a temptation in any Christian circle, is just to say, oh, Jesus was nice, so I have to be nice.
Yeah.
So if I'm nice, then I'm embodying Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus wasn't always nice.
No, I know.
Jesus was, just ask Martha. It's like, Lord, I'm doing all this. I'm doing all the food, and I'm cleaning up. And Mary's just sitting at your feet. It's like, actually, Martha, you are concerned and worried about many things. Mary has chosen the better part, and it will not be taken away from her. Stop grizzling. Shut up. You need to get to my feet and listen to what I'm talking about as well.
Yeah.
Zip it.
Yeah. And sorry,
Martha.
That's a point very well made, Tim, because it's interesting. When I read the Bible, I find it personally very challenging because there's a lot of tough things said directly to me as the reader.
Yeah.
You know, some tough things in the Old Testament. Let's not beat around the bush. And Jesus himself showed righteous indignation towards the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And
absolutely. Jonah's like, okay, go to Nineveh. No, I'm not going to Nineveh. I'm going to go the other way. Okay, you're going to end up in the belly of a whale. Okay, I'll go to Nineveh. Okay, guess what? You're all stuffed. The Lord's going to rain his judgment on you.
Yeah.
The Lord, and they go, oh my goodness, really? And the king is in sackcloth and ashes.
Yeah.
And then the Lord goes, well, hang on a minute. And Jonah's like, hey, wait on. I want you to destroy these people. I mean, it's just so challenging. It's not comfortable. It's not straightforward and it's not easy. That is why it's the narrow road.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Absolutely. So I apologize for hijacking my own interview, but we do have to.
This is outrageous. I'll never come back, Jonathan.
No. So now I've put myself in a challenging predicament of somehow trying to bring this home after. Doing the Australian thing and just at some point in this conversation about New Zealand, completely ignoring New Zealand and just moving on to my own
your own preoccupations. I think this is an occasion for prayer and reflection, Jonathan.
Yeah. So, okay, well, what's a good place to finish? A good note, a New Zealand note to finish on here. What about what about this one? I did want to ask this earlier. I don't know if it's a good place to finish, but it's where we're going to finish anyway. You know, if you talk to some conservative Christians in Australia, they will say, if you want to look at our apocalyptic future, look at New Zealand and or Canada.
Yep.
And so there's this perception. I think most people probably think Canada is the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Right.
Again, I'm you know, from the perspective of a conservative Christian. I even met someone who had a leadership role in a Christian organization here who was going off to Canada on a fact-finding mission to talk to Christians there to sort of learn how to brace for the tsunami coming in Australia down the track because, right. you know, Canada's already sold its soul to the devil or something like that. So, but
saying, are you suggesting could have saved themselves a whole bunch of dough and time by just coming to New Zealand? It was, what is it, $300 to cross the ditch?
I think the perception.
Did you like how I pronounced ditch?
I had no idea what you were talking about. No, I did. Yeah, Dutch. Yeah,
Dutch.
Yeah, Dutch. Yeah, I think the perception is Canada has kind of already jumped off the cliff. This is I have Canadian listeners too. I don't know if they'll be listening to this episode on
New Zealand.
And I want to speak to get a Canadian on the show sooner or later to actually get a kind of sense on the ground of what's happening there. But I think the general perception is that New Zealand is generally a progressive society, a non-Christian society, highly secular and more woke than Australia. It's not that Australia isn't those things, it's that there's more of a contest here. And I wondered if you thought there was any truth to that.
I think certainly that is true if we look at the way ideas are transacted in the public square. Because you're a larger country, and I think because of your culture and history, there are more. There's a spectrum of left and right. Not that spectrum is smaller in New Zealand, and also if I go back to there are the extremities there, but in terms of where most people get this, get their news or their opinion from. It's probably more centrist, which means it's not as broad a spectrum. Now, when I say the centrist is also, we have this desire for consensus, so we don't know in New Zealand how to disagree agreeably. I think there's often it becomes personal very quickly. I'm talking about as individuals here, but I think there's some of that as well. In our political modes as well, the sense that you have, and I'm actually, we've been doing a podcast on the election, and one of the challenges we've had is to find the generally good egg each week, which is someone who shatters the paradigm of people, people being antagonistic to political enemies, people running down political enemies, etc. And so the point being that we need more of that, I think, that robustness, the ability to be robust, that is still being modeled in Australia and to a more extreme extent in the US. But we don't want also the culture wars that can often occur when those cudgels are taken up. So it's a constant challenge. I'm in some sense I'm optimistic in that we are, because of our size, we are a sort of we're a large small town as a country, and so people know people who will hold opposing views. Whereas in the United States, for example, I don't know what it's like in Australia. It's possible to never ever meet a Republican. So you have a cartoon version. Should you be a Democrat? Vice versa, you're a Republican. If you never encounter Democrats, so I think in terms of whether we are more so-called progressive, I would say that's probably the case because of our culture and our history. But we also have a notion of government as benign, you think about the way Americans see central government. It's just, it's like, don't take my gun away from me because I don't trust central government. But we also in New Zealand do see, and I think this is because we're in many respects still a pioneer society, we see government as competent. So government's got to come and sort this issue out. I think those would then incline an acceptance of centralization, an acceptance of the, say, the sort of center-right view. But countervailing that, historically, New Zealand has elected more center-left view, if there's a sense of allowing government to do something and iterate. But historically, we've elected more center-right governments. So there's a paradoxical aspect to that as well.
Tim, thanks for a fascinating conversation across the ditch.
Can you pronounce, I'm going to count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sounds good to me. It's been an absolute pleasure, Jonathan.